Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
Nobody asked for our IDs, and when we held up our empty bottles and stared at our reflections in the glass, warped and ghostly, we knew why. And we weren't alone. Black bags grew beneath the eyes of the sons and daughters and wives of Crow. Their shoulders stooped, wrinkles enclosing their mouths like parentheses. Our fathers haunted us. They were everywhere.
That was Ted Marcoux reading a portion of Benjamin Percy's powerful, moving story, Refresh, Refresh. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, and I'm Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space on Broadway and 95th Street on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where Selected Shorts originates. This broadcast brings together several stories about and from the war in Iraq. The first of them is Benjamin Percy's story, Refresh, Refresh, which was first published in the Paris Review, then became part of the Best American Short Stories of 2006, edited by Ann Patchett and published by Houghton Mifflin, and will be included as the title story in Benjamin Percy's forthcoming book, Refresh, Refresh, published by the Grey Wolf Press. This is a story about the effect of the Iraq War on the home front, specifically a town in the western part of the United States in which most of the men have been called up as part of their reserve unit, but which leaves behind the young men, the teenagers, and the violence that becomes part of their lives. We do want to caution listeners that this powerful story does include some strong language. Here is Ted Marcoux reading Refresh, Refresh by Benjamin Percy.
When school let out, the two of us went to my backyard to fight. We were trying to make each other tougher. So in the grass, in the shade of the pines and the junipers, Gordon and I slung off our backpacks and laid down a pale green garden hose, tip to tip, making a ring. Then we stripped off our shirts and put on gold-colored boxing gloves and fought. Every round went 2 minutes. If you stepped out of the ring, you lost. If you cried, you lost. If you got knocked out or if you yelled stop, you lost. Afterward, we drank Coca-Colas and smoked Marlboros, our chests heaving, our faces all different shades of blacks and reds and yellows. We began fighting after Seth Johnson, a no-neck linebacker with teeth like corn kernels and hands like T-bone steaks, beat Gordon until his face swelled and split open and purpled around the edges. Eventually, he healed, the rough husks of scabs peeling away to reveal a different face from the one I remembered, older, squarer, fiercer, his left eyebrow separated by a gummy white scar. It was his idea that we should fight each other. He wanted to be ready. He wanted to hurt those who hurt him. And if he went down, he would go down swinging, as he was sure his father would. This is what we all wanted, to please our fathers, to make them proud, even though they had left us. This was in Crow, Oregon, a high desert town in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. In Crow, we have 1,500 people, a Dairy Queen, a BP gas station, a Food for Less, a meatpacking plant, a bright green football field irrigated by canal water, and your standard assortment of taverns and churches. Nothing distinguishes us from Bend or Redmond or Lapine or any of the other nowhere towns off Route 97 except for this. We are home to the 2nd Battalion, 34th Marines. The Marines live on a 50-acre base in the hills just outside of town, a collection of one-story cinder block buildings interrupted by cheatgrass and sagebrush. Throughout my childhood, I could hear, if I cupped a hand to my ear, the lowing of bulls, the bleating of sheep, and the report of assault rifles shouting from the hilltops. It's said that conditions here in Oregon's ranch country closely match the mountainous terrain of Afghanistan and northern Iraq. Our fathers, Gordon's and mine, were like the other fathers in Crow, all of them just about, had enlisted as part-time soldiers, as reservists, for drill pay. Several thousand a year for a private, several thousand more for a sergeant. Beer pay, they called it. And for 2 weeks every year, plus one weekend a month, they trained. They threw on their camis and filled their rucksacks and kissed us goodbye, and the gates of the 2nd Battalion drew closed behind them. Our fathers would vanish into the pine-studded hills, returning to us on Sunday night with their faces reddened from weather, their biceps trembling from fatigue, and their hands smelling of rifle grease. They would talk about ECPs and PRPs and MEUs and WMDs, and they would do push-ups in the middle of the living room, and they would call 6 o'clock 1800 hours, and they would high-five and yell Semper Fi. Then a few days would pass, and they would go back to the way they were, to the men we knew, Coors drinking, baseball throwing, crotch scratching, aqua velva smelling fathers. No longer. In January, the battalion was activated, and in March, they shipped off for Iraq. Our fathers, our coaches, our teachers, our barbers, our cooks, our gas station attendants and UPS delivery men and deputies and firemen and mechanics, our fathers, so many of them, climbed into the olive green school buses and pressed their palms to the windows and gave us the bravest, most hopeful smiles you can imagine and vanished, just like that. Nights, I sometimes got on my Honda dirt bike and rode through the hills and canyons of Deschutes County. Beneath me, the engine growled and shuddered, while all around me, the wind, like something alive, bullied me, tried to drag me from my bike. A dark world slipped past as I downshifted, leaning into a turn, and accelerated on a straightaway, my speed 70, then 80, concentrating only on the 20 yards of road glowing ahead of me. On this bike, I could ride and ride and ride. Away from here, up and over the Cascades, through the Willamette Valley, until I reached the ocean, where the broad black backs of whales regularly broke the surface of the water, and even farther, farther still, till I caught up with the horizon, where my father would be waiting. Inevitably, I ended up at Hole in the Ground. A long time ago, a meteor came screeching down from space and left behind a crater 5,000 feet wide and 300 feet deep. Hole in the Ground is frequented during the winter by the daredevil sledders among us and during the summer by bearded geologists interested in the metal fragments strewn across its bottom. I dangled my feet over the edge of the crater and leaned back on my elbows and took in the black sky. No moon, only stars. Just a little lighter than a raven. Every few minutes, a star seemed to come unstuck, streaking through the night in a bright flash that burned into nothingness. In the near distance, Crow glowed grayish-green against the darkness, a reminder of how close to oblivion we lived. A chunk of space ice or a solar wind could have jogged the meteor sideways, and rather than landing here, it could have landed there, at the intersection of Maine and Farwell. No Dairy Queen, no Crow High, no 2nd Battalion. Didn't take much imagination to realize how something can drop out of the sky and change everything. This was in October when Gordon and I circled each other in the backyard after school. We wore our golden boxing gloves, cracked with age and flaking when we pounded them together. Browned grass crunched beneath our sneakers and dust rose in little puffs like distress signals. Gordon was thin to the point of being scrawny. His collarbone poked against his skin like a swallowed coat hanger. His head was too big for his body and his eyes were too big for his head. And football players, Seth Johnson among them, regularly tossed him into garbage cans and called him E.T. He had had a bad day. And I could tell from the look on his face, the watery eyes, the trembling lips that revealed in quick flashes his buck teeth that he wanted, he needed to hit me. So I let him. I raised my gloves to my face and pulled my elbows against my ribs, and Gordon lunged forward, his arms snapping like rubber bands. I stood still, allowing his fists to work up and down my body, allowing him to throw the weight of his anger on me, until eventually he grew too tired to hit anymore. And I opened up my stance and floored him with a right cross to the temple. He lay there, sprawled out in the grass with a small smile on his E.T. face. "Damn," he said in a dreamy voice. A drop of blood gathered along the corner of his eye and streaked down his temple into his hair. My father wore steel-toed boots, Carhartt jeans, and a T-shirt advertising some place he had traveled to, maybe Yellowstone or Seattle. He looked like someone you might see shopping for motor oil at Bi-Mart. To hide his receding hairline, he wore a John Deere cap that laid a shadow across his face. His brown eyes blinked above a considerable nose, underlined by a gray mustache. Like me, my father was short and squat, a bulldog. His belly was a swollen bag and his shoulders were broad, good for carrying me during parades and at fairs when I was younger. He laughed a lot. He liked game shows. He drank too much beer and smoked too many cigarettes and spent too much time with his buddies, fishing, hunting, bullshitting, which probably had something to do with why my mother divorced him and moved to Boise with a hairdresser and triathlete named Chuck. At first, after my father left, like all of the other fathers, he would email me whenever he could. He would tell me about the heat, the gallons of water he drank every day, the sand that got into everything, the baths he took with baby wipes. He would tell me how safe he was, how very safe. This was when he was stationed in Turkey, then the reservist shipped for Kirkuk, where insurgents and sandstorms attacked almost daily. The emails came less frequently. Weeks of silence passed between them. Sometimes, on the computer, I would hit refresh. Refresh, refresh, hoping. In October, I received an email that read, "Hi, Josh, I'm okay. Don't worry. Do your homework. Love, Dad." I printed it and hung it on my door with a piece of scotch tape. For 20 years, my father worked at Nozier Inc., the bullet manufacturer based out of Bend, and the Marines trained him as an ammunition technician. Gordon liked to say his father was a gunnery sergeant, and he was, but we all knew he was also the battalion mess manager, a cook, which was how he made his living in Crow, tending the grill at Hamburger Patties. We knew their titles, but we didn't know, not really, what their titles meant, what our fathers did over there. We imagined them doing heroic things, rescuing Iraqi babies from burning huts, sniping suicide bombers before they could detonate on a crowded city street. We drew on Hollywood and TV news to develop elaborate scenarios where maybe at twilight during a trek through the mountains of northern Iraq, bearded insurgents ambushed our fathers with rocket launchers. We imagined them silhouetted by a fiery explosion. We imagined them burrowing into the sand like lizards and firing their M16s, their bullets streaking through the darkness like the meteorites I observed on sleepless nights. And when Gordon and I fought, we painted our faces black and green and brown with the camo grease our fathers left behind. It made our eyes and teeth appear startlingly white, and it smeared away against our gloves just as the grass smeared away beneath our sneakers, and the ring became a circle of dirt. The dirt a reddish color that looked a lot like scabbed flesh. One time, Gordon hammered my shoulder so hard I couldn't lift my arm for a week. Another time, I elbowed one of his kidneys and he peed blood. We struck each other with such force and frequency that the golden gloves crumbled and our knuckles showed through the sweat-soaked, blood-soaked foam like teeth through a busted lip. So we bought another set of gloves. And as the air grew steadily colder, we fought with steam blasting from our mouths. Our fathers had left us, but men remained in Crow. They were old men, like my grandfather, whom I lived with. men who had paid their dues, who had worked their jobs and fought their wars and now spent their days at the gas station drinking bad coffee from styrofoam cups, complaining about the weather, arguing about the best months to reap alfalfa. And there were incapable men, men who rarely shaved and watched daytime television in their once white underpants, men who lived in trailers and filled their shopping carts with Bush Light, summer sausage, Oreo cookies. And then there were vulturous men like Dave Leitner, men who scavenged whatever our fathers had left behind. Dave Leitner worked as a recruitment officer. I'm guessing he was the only recruitment officer in world history who drove a Vespa scooter with a Support Our Troops ribbon magnet on its rear. We sometimes saw it parked outside the homes of young women whose husbands had gone to war. Dave had big ears and small eyes and wore his hair in your standard issue high and tight buzz. He often spoke in a too loud voice about all the insurgents he gunned down when working a Fallujah patrol unit. He lived with his mother in Crow, but spent his days in Bend and Redmond, trolling the parking lots of Best Buy, Shopko, Kmart, Walmart, Mountain View Mall. He was looking for people like us, people who were angry and dissatisfied and poor. But Dave Leitner knew better than to bother us. On duty, he stayed away from Crow entirely. Recruiting there would be too much like poaching the burned section of forest where deer, rib-slatted and wobbly-legged, nosed through the ash, seeking something green. We didn't fully understand the reason our fathers were fighting. We understood only that they had to fight. The necessity of it made the reason irrelevant. It's all part of the game, my grandfather said. It's just the way it is. We could only cross our fingers and wish on stars and hit refresh, refresh, hoping that they would return to us, praying that we would never find Dave Leitner on our porch uttering the words, "I regret to inform you." One time, my grandfather dropped Gordon and me off at Mountain View Mall, and there, near the glass-doored entrance, stood Dave Leitner. He wore his creased khaki uniform and spoke with a group of Mexican teenagers. They were laughing, shaking their heads, and walking away from him as we approached. We had our hats pulled low, and he didn't recognize us. "Question for you, gentlemen," he said in the voice of telemarketers and door-to-door Jehovah's Witnesses. "What do you plan on doing with your lives?" Gordon pulled off his hat with a flourish, as if he were part of some ta-da magic act, and his face was the trick. "I'm planning on killing some crazy-ass Muslims," he said and forced a smile. "How about you, Josh?" "Yeah," I said, "kill some people, then get myself killed." I grimaced even as I played along. "That sounds like a good plan." Dave Leitner's lips tightened into a thin line. His posture straightened, and he asked us what we thought our fathers would think hearing us right now. "They're out there risking their lives, defending our freedom, and you're cracking sick jokes," he said. "I think that's sick." We hated him for his soft hands and clean uniform. We hated him because he sent people like us off to die. Because at 23, he had attained a higher rank than our fathers. Because he slept with the lonely wives of soldiers. And now we hated him even more for making us feel ashamed. I wanted to say something sarcastic, but Gordon was quicker. His hand was out before him, his fingers gripping an imaginary bottle. "Here's your maple syrup," he said, Dave said. "And what is that for?" "To eat my with," Gordon said. Right then, a skateboarder type with green hair and a nose ring walked from the mall, a bag full of DVDs swinging from his fist, and Dave Leitner forgot us. "Hey, friend," he was saying. "Let me ask you something. Do you like war movies?" In November, we drove our dirt bikes deep into the woods to hunt. Sunlight fell through tall pines and birch clusters and lay in puddles along the logging roads that wound past the hillsides, packed with huckleberries and on the moraines where coyotes scurried, trying to flee from us and slipping, causing tiny avalanches of loose rock. It hadn't rained in nearly a month, So the crabgrass and the cheatgrass and the pine needles had lost their color, as dry and blonde as corn husks, crackling beneath my boots when the road we followed petered out into nothing and I stepped off my bike. In this waterless stillness, it seemed you could hear every chipmunk within a square acre rustling for pine nuts. And when the breeze rose into a cold wind, the forest became a giant whisper. We dumped our tent and our sleeping bags near a basalt grotto with a spring bubbling from it, and Gordon said, "Let's go, troops," holding his rifle before his chest diagonally as a soldier would. He dressed as a soldier would, too, wearing his father's overlarge camis rather than the mandatory blaze orange gear. 50 feet apart, we worked our way downhill through the forest, through a huckleberry thicket, through a clear cut crowded with stumps, taking care not to make much noise or slip on the pine needles carpeting the ground. A chipmunk whirring at a pine cone screeched its astonishment when a peregrine falcon swooped down and seized it, carrying it off between the trees to some secret place. Its wings made no sound, and neither did the blaze orange-clad hunter when he appeared in a clearing several hundred yards below us. Gordon made some sort of SWAT team gesture, meant, I think, to say, "Stay low," and I made my way carefully toward him. From behind a boulder, we peered through our scopes, tracking the hunter, who looked, in his vest and ear-flapped hat, like a monstrous pumpkin. "That sucker," Gordon said in a harsh whisper. The hunter was Seth Johnson. His rifle was strapped to his back and his mouth was moving. He was talking to someone. At the corner of the meadow, he joined four members of the varsity football squad who sat on logs around a smoldering campfire, their arms bobbing like oil pump jacks as they brought their beers to their mouths. I took my eye from my scope and noticed Gordon fingering the trigger of his .30-06. I told him to quit fooling around, and he pulled his hand suddenly away from the stock and smiled guiltily and said he just wanted to know what it felt like having that power over someone. Then his trigger finger rose up and touched the gummy white scar that split his eyebrow. "I say we fuck with him a little." I shook my head no. Gordon said, "Just a little, to scare them." "They've got guns," I said, and he said, "So we'll come back tonight." Later, after an early dinner of beef jerky and trail mix and Gatorade, I happened upon a four-point stag nibbling on some beer grass, and I rested my rifle on a stump and shot it, and it stumbled backwards and collapsed with a rose blooming from behind its shoulder where the heart was hidden. Gordon came running, and we stood around the deer and smoked a few cigarettes, watching the thick arterial blood run from its mouth. Then we took out our knives and got to work. I cut around the anus, cutting away the penis and testes, and then ran the knife along the belly, unzipping the hide to reveal the delicate pink flesh and greenish vessels into which our hands disappeared. The blood steamed in the cold mountain air, and when we finished, when we'd skinned the deer and hacked at its joints and cut out its back strap and boned out its shoulders and hips, its neck and ribs, making chops, roasts, steaks, quartering the meat so we could bundle it into our insulated saddlebags, Gordon picked up the deer head by the antlers and held it before his own. Blood from its neck made a pattering sound on the ground, and in the half-light of early evening, Gordon began to do a little dance, bending his knees, stomping his feet. "I think I got an idea," he said, and he pretended to charge at me with the antlers. I pushed him away, and he said, "Don't pussy out on me, Josh." I was exhausted and reeked of gore, but I could appreciate the need for revenge. "Just to scare them, right, Gordo?" I said. "Right." We lugged our meat back to camp, and Gordon brought the deer hide. He slit a hole in its middle and poked his head through so the hide hung off him loosely, a hairy sack, and I helped him smear mud and blood across his face. Then, with his leather man, he sawed off the antlers and held them in each hand and slashed at the air as if they were claws. Night had come on, and the moon hung over the Cascades, grayly lighting our way as we crept through the forest, imagining ourselves in enemy territory, with tripwires and guard towers and snarling dogs around every corner. From behind the boulder that overlooked their campsite, we observed our enemies as they swapped hunting stories and joked about Jessica Robertson's big passed around a bottle of whiskey and drank to excess and finally pissed on the fire to extinguish it. When they retired to their tents, we waited an hour before making our way down the hill, with such care that it took us another hour before we were upon them. Somewhere an owl hooted, its noise barely noticeable over the chorus of snores that rose from their tents. Seth's Bronco was parked nearby. The license plate read S-Man, and all their rifles lay in the cab. I collected the guns, slinging them over my shoulder. Then I eased my knife into each of Seth's tires. I still had my knife out when we were standing beside Seth's tent, and when a cloud scudded over the moon and made the meadow fully dark, I stabbed the nylon and in one quick jerk opened up a slit. Gordon rushed in, his antler claws slashing. I could see nothing but shadows, but I could hear Seth scream the scream of a little girl as Gordon raked at him with the antlers and hissed and howled like some cave creature hungry for man flesh. When the tents around us came alive with confused voices, Gordon reemerged with a horrible smile on his face, and I followed him up the hillside, crashing through the undergrowth, leaving Seth to make sense of the nightmare that had descended upon him without warning. Winter came. Snow fell. And we threw on our coveralls and wrenched on our studded tires and drove our dirt bikes to hole in the ground, dragging our sleds behind us with tow ropes. Our engines filled the white silence of the afternoon. Our back tires kicked up plumes of powder and on sharp turns slipped out beneath us, and we lay there in the middle of the road, bleeding, laughing, unafraid. Earlier, for lunch, we had cooked a pound of bacon with a stick of butter. The grease, which hardened into a white waxy pool, we used as polish, buffing it into the bottoms of our sleds. Speed was what we wanted at hole in the ground. We descended the steepest section of the crater into its heart, 300 feet below us. We followed each other in the same track, ironing down the snow to create a chute, blue-hued and frictionless, that would allow us to travel at a speed equivalent to free fall. Our eyeballs glazed with frost, our ears roared with wind, and our stomachs rose into our throats as we rocketed down and felt as if we were five again. And then we began the slow climb back the way we came, and I felt 50. We wore crampons and ascended in a zigzagging series of switchbacks. It took nearly an hour. The air had begun to go purple with evening when we stood again at the lip of the crater, sweating in our coveralls, taking in the view through the fog of our breath. Gordon packed a snowball. I said, "You'd better not hit me with that." He cocked his arm threateningly and smiled, then dropped to his knees to roll the snowball into something bigger. He rolled it until it grew to the size of a large man curled into the fetal position. From the back of his bike, he took the piece of garden hose he used to siphon gas from fancy foreign cars, and he worked it into his tank, sucking at its end until gas flowed. He doused the giant snowball as if he hoped it would sprout. It didn't melt. He packed it tight enough, but it puckered slightly and appeared leaden. And when Gordon withdrew his Zippo, sparked it, and held it toward the ball, the fumes caught flame and the whole thing erupted with a gasping noise that sent me staggering back a few steps. Gordon rushed forward and kicked the ball of fire, sending it rolling, tumbling down the crater, down our chute like a meteor, and the snow beneath it instantly melted, only to freeze again a moment later, making a slick blue ribbon. When we sledded it, we went so fast our minds emptied, and we felt a sensation at once like flying and falling. On the news, Iraqi insurgents fired their assault rifles. On the news, a car bomb in Baghdad blew up seven American soldiers at a traffic checkpoint. On the news, the president said he did not think it was wise to provide a time frame for troop withdrawal. I checked my email before breakfast and found nothing but spam. Gordon and I fought in the snow wearing snow boots. We fought so much our wounds never got a chance to heal, and our faces took on a permanent look of decay. Our wrists felt swollen, our knees ached, our joints felt full of tiny dry wasps. We fought until fighting hurt too much, and we took up drinking instead. Weekends, we drove our dirt bikes to Bend, 20 miles away, and bought beer and took it to hole in the ground and drank there until a bright line of sunlight appeared on the horizon and illuminated the snow-blanketed desert. Nobody asked for IDs. And when we held up our empty bottles and stared at our reflections in the glass, warped and ghostly, we knew why. And we weren't alone. Black bags grew beneath the eyes of the sons and daughters and wives of Crow. Their shoulders stooped, wrinkles enclosing their mouths like parentheses. Our fathers haunted us. They were everywhere. In the grocery store when we spotted a 30-pack of Coors on sale for 10 bucks. On the highway when we passed a jacked-up Dodge with a dozen hay bales stacked in its bed. In the sky when a jet roared by, reminding us of faraway places. And now, as our bodies thickened with muscle, as we stopped shaving and grew patchy beards, we saw our fathers even in the mirror. We began to look like them. Our fathers, who had been taken from us, were everywhere, at every turn, imprisoning us. Seth Johnson's father was a staff sergeant. Like his son, he was a big man, but not big enough. Just before Christmas, he stepped on a cluster bomb. A U.S. warplane dropped it, and the sand camouflaged it, and he stepped on it, and it tore him into many meaty pieces. When Dave Leitner climbed up the front porch with a black armband and a somber expression, Mrs. Johnson, who was cooking a honeyed ham at the time, collapsed on the kitchen floor. Seth pushed his way out the door and punched Dave in the face, breaking his nose before he could utter the words, "I regret to inform you." Hearing about this, we felt bad for all of 10 seconds. Then we felt good because it was his father and not ours. And then we felt bad again. And on Christmas Eve, we drove to Seth's house and laid down on his porch the rifles we had stolen, along with a 6-pack of Coors. And then, just as we were about to leave, Gordon dug in his back pocket and removed his wallet and placed under the 6-pack all the money he had, a few fives, some ones. "Christmas," he said. We got braver and went to the bars, the Golden Nugget, the Weary Traveler, the Pine Tavern, where we square danced with older women wearing purple eyeshadow and sparkly dream catcher earrings and push-up bras and clattery high heels. We told them we were Marines back from a 6-month deployment, and they said, "Really?" And we said, "Yes, ma'am." And when they asked for our names, we gave them the names of our fathers. Then we bought them drinks, and they drank them in a gulping way and breathed hotly in our faces. And we brought our mouths against theirs, and they tasted like menthol cigarettes, like burnt detergent. And then we went home with them, to their trailers, to their waterbeds, where among their stuffed animals, we fucked them. Mid-afternoon, and it was already full dark. On our way to the Weary Traveler, we stopped by my house to bum some money off my grandfather, only to find Dave Leitner waiting for us. He must have just gotten there. He was halfway up the porch steps when our headlights cast an anemic glow over him, and he turned to face us with a scrunched-up expression as if trying to figure out who we were. He wore the black band around his arm and over his nose a white bandaged splint. We did not turn off our engines. Instead, we sat in the driveway, idling, the exhaust from our bikes and the breath from our mouths clouding the air. Above us, a star hissed across the moonlit sky, vaguely bright like a light turned on in a daylit room. And Dave began down the steps, and we leapt off our bikes to meet him. Before he could speak, I brought my fist to his diaphragm, knocking the breath from his body. He looked like a gunshot actor in Western, clutching his belly with both hands, doubled over, his face making a nice target for Gordon's knee. A sound snapped. Preceded Dave falling on his back with blood coming from his already broken nose. He put up his hands, and we hit our way through them. I punched him once, twice in the ribs while Gordon kicked him in the spine and stomach, and then we stood around gulping air and allowed him to struggle to his feet. And when he righted himself, he wiped his face with his hand. Blood dripped from his fingers. I moved in and roundhoused with my right and then my left, my fists knocking his head loose on its hinges. Again, he collapsed, a bloody bag of a man, his eyes walled and turned up, trying to see the animals' bodies looming over him. He opened his mouth to speak, and I pointed a finger at him, and I said with enough hatred in my voice to break a back, "Don't say a word. Don't you dare. Not one word. And he closed his mouth and tried to crawl away, and I brought a boot down on the back of his skull and left it there a moment, grinding his face into the ground so that when he lifted his head, the snow held a red impression of his face. Gordon went inside and returned a moment later with a roll of duct tape, and we held Dave down and bound his wrists and ankles and threw him on a sled and taped him to it many times over and then tied the sled to the back of Gordon's bike and drove at a perilous speed to a hole in the ground. The moon shone down and the snow glowed with pale blue light as we smoked cigarettes looking down into the crater with Dave at our feet. There was something childish about the way our breath puffed from our mouths in tiny clouds. It was as if we were imitating choo-choo trains. And for a moment, just a moment, we were kids again. Just a couple of stupid kids. Gordon must have felt this too because he said, "My mom wouldn't even let me play with toy guns when I was little." And he sighed heavily as if he couldn't understand how we had ended up here. Then, with a sudden lurch, Dave began struggling and yelling at us in a slurred voice, and my face hardened with anger, and I put my hands on him and pushed him slowly to the lip of the crater, and he grew silent. For a moment, I forgot myself, staring off into the dark oblivion. It was beautiful and horrifying. "I could shove you right now," I said, "and if I did, you'd be dead." "Please don't," he said, his voice cracking. He began to cry. "Oh, don't, please." Hearing his great shuddering sobs didn't bring me the satisfaction I'd hoped for. If anything, I felt as I did that day so long ago when we taunted him in the Mountain View Mall parking lot. Shameful, false. "Ready?" I said. "One," I inched him a little close to the edge. "Two," I moved him a little closer still, and as I did, I felt unwieldy, at once wild and exhausted, my body seeming to take on another 20, 30, 40 years. And when I finally said three, my voice was barely a whisper. We left Dave there, sobbing at the brink of the crater. Got on our bikes and we drove to Bend. We drove so fast I imagined catching fire like a meteor, burning up in a flash, howling as my heat consumed me, as we made our way to the U.S. Marine recruiting office, where we would at last answer the fierce alarm of war and put our pens to paper and make our fathers proud.
That was Ted Marcoux reading Benjamin Percy's story, Refresh, Refresh. And I was able to talk with Benjamin Percy about this remarkable story. Hi, Ben. It's nice to talk with you.
Great to talk to you as well.
Your story, Refresh, Refresh, is such a powerful one, and it had such an effect on our audiences. Now, the story isn't a side of the home front American story that we've seen portrayed anywhere before. How did this story evolve for you? How did you think about writing it?
I think that so many of us have been watching television and hearing news reports and become numb to the death tolls as they accumulate. And the idea was to make it new again, to pick the scab and let the blood flow, because I feel a kind of guilt every time I get onto CNN and see a news report that a suicide bomber has detonated in a city street and annihilated seven more soldiers. When that goes through my system without much effect, I felt a need to put it on the page in a fresh light, which was to channel the battleground at home. The friends and family of U.S. soldiers are experiencing as their loved ones go overseas, and some of them meeting their end, some of them having their bodies destroyed, their minds destroyed, some of them coming home as heroes. It's a disorienting time for the nation, and I wanted to not only capture a side of the country that doesn't often get a voice, the rural country of Oregon, but also to capture the other side of the war, the other side of the coin.
Did you observe anything like the events of your story in the town you grew up in? Would you tell us about that town?
It is a town called Tumalo, located in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains, and it's an extreme environment. It's blisteringly hot during the summers, and it's devastatingly cold during the winters. And it's in the shadow of the forest and the shadow of the mountains, so people there feel small sometimes, feel dwarfed by their environment. And it's my backyard. It's a place I've been writing about for years.
Is it in the shadow of a major military base, as in
the story? It isn't. That was invented. That came out of that was an article I read about a small town in Ohio where overnight 14 fathers, brothers, uncles, sons died in an ambush. And in reading that article where a mother was interviewed and she expressed her grief, it really touched me in a way that I thought I could channel that emptiness that she was feeling into the place where I had grown up, a place where if that many men were to vanish just like that, it would leave behind an enormous cavity.
Has it often been the case that a single town has had so large a part of its population be part of a reserve unit, then when that reserve unit is activated, has found itself without the fathers and sons and uncles that the young men in your story think about and emulate and miss?
I think so, sadly. In some of these places, especially where troops are continuously deployed, when they come back and receive a small respite before heading overseas once again, there's an accumulation of death that's happening over these past 5 years that is taking its toll on the psyche of so many families. And, you know, at the end of this story, there's nobody there to tap you on the shoulder and say everything is going to be all right, because it isn't. And I think that's what all of us are feeling right now.
And is there the likelihood that such violence would have been part of these young men's lives, even if their fathers had not been called to Iraq or Afghanistan? Are these violent kids, no matter what, because of the place they live and because of the way they're brought up and educated and hang out with violent friends?
Certainly these are outsiders, and I've always been interested in outsiders, having been shuttled from school district to school district, town to town as a kid. I was on the periphery often, and so feel a kind of kinship with mm-hmm. those who aren't necessarily in the mainstream and who are barely treading water at times. So would they be violent? Perhaps to some degree, but what's happening here is they're swinging their fists in an attempt to, you know, get the pain inside of them out. And that pain comes from having fathers who have left them and who are fighting a war they don't necessarily understand. If you look at the title of the story, though, Refresh, Refresh, it refers not only to the loneliness they feel as they hit refresh, refresh on their keyboard, hoping that an email will pop up from their fathers, but also captures the generational refreshment of troops. A grandfather,
right.
World War II became the father's Vietnam, became a son's Iraq, and so on. So really what I wanted to say in the end wasn't something didactic, wasn't something editorial. I didn't have a pre-planned agenda to poo-poo the war. More so, I wanted this to be a character-driven piece where they are as drawn to the military as they are disturbed by it.
Which is why it ends up with their taking that destined walk to the recruiting office and signing up.
Precisely. And
even
also,
though they have had the most violent confrontation with the recruiter who's hustling other young men to join up.
Indeed. And at that moment, at the brink of the crater, they threaten to push him over the edge, but don't. And it's that push-pull
right.
that I think nutshells the spirit of the story.
Was it a upsetting business for you to write this story, to get it down on paper, knowing that it would have this kind of effect on its hearers and listeners and readers?
It was, I suppose, the equivalent of standing in that ring in the backyard and putting on my own gold-colored boxing gloves and taking the keyboard to task.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain catharsis involved, but I had no idea that the story would have this profound of an impact. I don't think you ever do. As a writer, you're communicating alone with a computer screen. And if you think too much about what might happen to the work, it will freeze you there.
Well, what about the experience of hearing it read aloud in public? I remember when we met on stage at Symphony Space at the reception following that reading, you looked a little, well, stunned that this was all happening.
That was an amazing experience, one I'm forever grateful for. And you know, such an affirmation. And being able to spy on people, being able to sit in the audience, unknown, and hear them gasp and hear them laugh and to see them shake their heads, to see one woman towards the end cover her ears. I hope it wasn't because she thought the prose was too terrible.
I'm sure not.
That made me physically shake. I was so excited by it because I've said this often before, that writing is so much like howling in the middle of a cornfield. And when somebody comes into the corn and says, "I heard you," that's a tremendous, you know, feeling, knowing that you have connected with someone, knowing that your work, a work that has felt like, you know, something born out of a hermit, can actually have a communal effect.
And you felt that the reading by the actor we chose was in the right world of the story?
I thought he did a genius job. He captured almost supernaturally the voice that I had imagined for the piece.
You may know that after that evening, we went on one of our periodic tours to places where Selected Shorts is on the radio, and that actor, Ted Marcoux, came with us to read the story in not a New York setting, but in a Western setting in America. And I think it was just as powerful there, if not more so.
I wish I could shake his hand again, because his voice continues to resonate with me.
What are you working on lately? What are you working on right now?
A son. He takes up a great deal of my time. He's 11 months old.
Right.
And he's the primary text in my life right now.
But you're not editing him, I hope.
I continue to work on short stories. I feel like I'm wed to the form, even as I work on a novel, which takes place, as you might expect, in the high desert of Central Oregon. And concerns, of course, men on the fringe.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. Ben Percy, the author of Refresh, Refresh.
Thank you.
You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com. We continue this program of stories about and from the Iraq War with several selections from the volume Operation Homecoming, published by Random House, which we turned into a program at Symphony Space called Writing the Wartime Experience, hosted by Dana Joya, the chairman of the NEA, and by Andrew Carroll, the editor of Operation Homecoming. We'll hear three poems, Billy Hill Hunt's poem Buzz Saw, and two by Sergeant Brian Turner, Ashba and The Baghdad Zoo. They are read respectively by Joan Allen, Chris Chalk, and Stephen Lang.
The next three items are short poems, and Andy will tell you about them.
Some military spouses go to great lengths to ease the pain of separation when their loved ones are deployed. A month before Billy Hill Hunt's husband, U.S. Army Specialist Corey T. Hunt, left for Iraq in January of 2005, she secretly made an audio tape of his sleeping.
Buzzsaw. I used to say, "You're cutting down an entire forest with your snoring." Now without it, bedtime seems boring. I recorded you the last time you were here. Call me crazy, but I play it from time to time just to keep you near.
Sergeant Brian Turner crossed the border into Iraq in December 3, 2003, and spent almost 11 months in Baghdad and Mosul. Nicknamed the Professor, Turner had earned a master's degree in poetry from the University of Oregon and composed numerous works during his deployment. Turner kept the poems to himself, however, as he didn't want the men to think that he was writing about flowers and stuff. In fact, Turner's poems offer profound reflections on the haunting and nightmarish realities of warfare and the immense pain that military operations can inflict on troops and civilians alike. Ashbaugh, which is also the title of this first of two poems by Turner, is the transliteration of the Arabic word for ghosts.
Chris Chalk.
Ashbaugh. The ghosts of American soldiers wander the streets of Balad by night, unsure of their way home, exhausted, the desert wind blowing trash down the narrow alleys as a voice sounds from the minaret, a soulful call reminding each of them how alone they are and lost, how the army gunboats sway moored on the Tigris, the pontoon bridge groaning beneath them as they move to the center of the river, as bats skim just over the surface where the moonlight slides into the darkness below. And the Iraqi dead, they watch in silence from the rooftops as date palms line the shore in silhouette, leaning toward Mecca when the dawn wind blows.
The last of the three poems is called The Baghdad Zoo. It was written by Sergeant Brian Turner. Andy?
Baghdad Zoo is based loosely on stories that Turner heard concerning the damage and looting done to the city's main zoo during the March 2003 invasion of Iraq. Barking dunes are crescent-shaped sand dunes.
Stephen Lang.
An Iraqi northern brown bear mauled a man on a street corner, dragging him down an alley as shocked onlookers cried for it to stop. There were tanks rolling their heavy tracks past the museum and up to the Ministry of Oil. One gunner watched a lion chase down a horse. Eaten down to their skeletons, the giraffes looked prehistoric, unreal, their necks too fragile, too graceful for the 21st century. Surreal. Dalmatian pelicans and marbled teals flew over, frightened by the rotor wash of Black Hawk helicopters touching down. One baboon even escaped from the city limits. It was found wandering in the desert, confused by the wind and the sand of the Barking Dunes.
We've heard three poems from Operation Homecoming: Billy Hill Hunt's Buzzsaw, Sergeant Brian Turner's Ashbaugh, and Sergeant Brian Turner's The Baghdad Zoo, read by Joan Allen, Chris Chalk, and Stephen Lang. We continue now with a personal narrative from that volume. It was written by Sergeant Michael A. Thomas, and it's entitled 3 a.m. in Bangor, Maine. The reader, once again, is Stephen Lang.
After months of extending our stay in Iraq, our unit was finally going home. The year had felt long enough. We had missed birthdays, births, anniversaries, Thanksgiving, and Christmas. And when the plane that was scheduled to take us back to the States was hit by a de-icing truck in Germany, we were left feeling as though we'd never return to our families. We were ordered to deplane and had to wait for the next flight. Sitting in the airport throughout the night, we called our families with the bad news. We waited for what seemed like an eternity before finally catching another plane. 36 hours after our scheduled arrival, we landed in Bangor, Maine. It was 3 a.m. We were tired, hungry, and as desperate as we were to get to Colorado,
Our excitement was tainted with bitterness. While we were originally told our National Guard deployment would be mere months, here we were, 369 days later, frustrated and angry. As I walked off the plane, I was taken aback. In the small, dimly lit airport, a group of elderly veterans were there waiting for us, lined up one by one to shake our hands. Some were standing, others were confined to wheelchairs, and all of them wore their uniform hats. Their now feeble right hands stiffened in salutes, their left hands holding coffee, snacks, and cell phones for us. As I made my way through the line, each man thanking me for my service, I choked back tears. Here we were, returning from 1 year in Iraq where we had portable DVD players, 3 square meals and phones, being honored by men who had crawled through mud for years with little more than the occasional letter from home. Few of them appeared to be veterans of the war in Vietnam, and I couldn't help but think of how they were treated when they came back to the U.S. And yet here they were to support us. These soldiers, many of whom had lost limbs, and comrades, shook our hands proudly, as if our service could somehow rival their own. We later learned that this VFW group had waited for more than a day in the airport for our arrival. When the time came to fly home to Colorado, we were asked by our commander if we would like to join the veterans of foreign wars. Every hand in the unit went up eagerly, including my own. Looking back on my year in Iraq, I can honestly say that my perception of the experience was changed, not so much by the soldiers with whom I served, though I consider them my saving grace, but by the soldiers who welcomed us home. For it is those men who reminded me what serving my country is truly about.
That was Stephen Lang reading 3 a.m. in Bangor, Maine by Sergeant Michael A. Thomas from the Random House volume Operation Homecoming. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.